This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 349 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Carlene Z. Carlene Z has a very special place in our hearts. We've known her for, oh my goodness, years now.
And she's one of the original Pod Abroad members. Speaking she of, is. There is still room Uh-oh. On Pod Abroad 2021, y'all.
There is. And to find out more, all you have to do is, because we're that special, we own... At least for now, we own the domain. All you have to do is go to www.podabroad.com to find out more about that trip, which was going to be May 2021. It's now going to be September 2021. So to give us a little more time because, pandemic and all that, international travel.
And if you're like me and you've literally only been to Scotland in May, change it up. Let's go in September. Let's go together. Let's go experience the quote unquote fall weather in Scotland. I'm excited. I don't know if you guys are, but I'm super excited to see Scotland where something different than gorse is blooming. All right, here we go. This week, we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with our special guest, Casey Dyer, with chapter 13, entitled Safe Hands.
So Jamie does what he needs to do. So in chapter 12, we had ended, Diana had ended it saying that Jamie was going off to, he was comparing speaking with Claire versus Roger Mack versus Brianna about the future and how it made him feel completely differently depending on whom he spoke to. And he really got excitement or interest, feelings of interest or excitement from Claire and Brianna. And he really didn't love talking to Roger Mack about the future because he had such a, a historian's kind of factual coldness about it. And so he wasn't really looking forward to it. But he's done what he's going to do. He's talked about getting him to go out and do the trip to pick up the new batch of settlers. And he does what he needs to do. He comes home to Claire near dark. And Claire is tired. She's resting her eyes, her head on her arms. And in their kind of back and forth conversation, she says, no, she hasn't eaten. She's been waiting for him to have dinner. She's indeed been taking care of Lizzie all day, which, was the last thing we heard about Lizzie was that she had fainted and was taken upstairs, having a malarial attack. That gallberry syrup that she'd made to be given to Lizzie, well, Lizzie had thrown up multiple times, and she'd thrown up on Bobby, thankfully, not Claire. And so she's telling him all of this, and by the way, Bobby has hookworms.
Hang on. So as I was reading this chapter, I was trying to imagine what that syrup tasted like. And when she mentioned that it was gallberry, the only thing I can think about gall is stomach acid or bile. It made me think of bile.
Yeah, me too. I agree with you. That's what came to my mind as well.
So I was just imagining trying to be this is good for you. And giving someone a mouthful of stomach acid. And I'm I wouldn't hold that down either.
I don't think we would. No, I don't think I would.
But then I wanted to know what the bread tasted like that she handed him. Did it taste like goose grease, the grease or the gallberry?
Yeah, that's what I think. I think it was because she had the goose grease and the gallberry on her hands and she tried to get it off her hands.
Oh, gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, we tried. It wouldn't, couldn't get it out.
I mean, I like sourdough and all, but that's not a flavor that's probably pleasant.
the Jamies, as I said, Jamie's been talking to Roger about the native peoples and also the Protestants that he's about to go pick up. And Jamie notes something odd. This is what you guys were saying. He notes something odd about the bread. And she's all, well, Lizzie couldn't keep the syrup down. I remembered that I had some, that quinine could be absorbed through the skin. So I mixed it up into some goose grease and rubbed it all over her. Seems to have worked, but then it also, she couldn't get it off. So it also got into the bread.
Well, but that totally fed back into the title for the chapter, which is Safe Hands, which she does not have hands for preparing a slice of bread.
Yes, in this moment, correct. She also has some stuff to give Bobby for his worms. Diana writes about the different thing, Ipecacuanus or whatever it's called. There's something that she has given or will give to him. Quote, he looked tired and there were, and this is Jamie. He looked tired and there were small twin lines between his heavy brows, unquote. And what I wrote was, this is called a glabella, which gives you the vertical lines between your brows. Jamie, you need Botox.
Botox. I had a dream. This is so off topic. I'm so sorry for saying this, but I had a dream last night that I went and got Botox.
Oh,
and
Lord.
I could not feel my whole face. Totally unrelated, but you said Botox and it made me think of that.
Hey, it's okay. That's kind of how we roll. Feel free, Casey, to just like anything that a tangential, just like pop in.
Well, the only thing that has leapt out to me is that when Jamie speaks to her and says that she's asleep when he walks in, and he says, you look as though you've been dragged through a hedge backward. And I could, I could so relate to that. That's exactly how my hair looks right now.
Oh no.
Yeah.
I've been I'm so glad this is not a video chat.
Yeah. I know. Consider yourself lucky.
And then he asks her to help him count all the times he's come close to dying. And so there's that allusion, or hardly even an allusion, to that fortune teller again. And this is what I wrote. Un, deux, trois, quatre, sept, cinq, six, sept, huit, neuf.
Okay, well, the thing that I took away from that
Hamilton
was that how happy I was that it was a reference that Diana Gabaldon didn't leave for four books before she brought back up again. And it was literally just like a couple chapters ago that we had the whole evil fortune teller
moment. I think it was the last chapter, yeah.
And then so it was like almost immediately brought back up again, which to me was a relief because I hate having to hold on to stuff like that for years and be like, wait, was that mentioned before? So it was nice to get like an immediate payoff.
But here's my question. Did either of you stop and try to guess before it went any further? Because that's what I did. When he says, Sassanach, he says, suddenly putting down his glass, how many times would you say have I come close to dying? I stopped right there and guessed. I guessed seven. So I was wrong because I guessed seven and they came up with five. But I feel like there's just been poor Jamie has been near death so many times in this series.
I can make an argument for six or seven, and I've listed all them out. But to answer your specific question, no. And the reason was I need to get through the chapter and take notes. However, if I'm reading it, if I'm listening, not so much, I let it go. But if I'm reading it and it's not for the purpose of taking notes, absolutely, I might say, huh, I wonder what, you know, I just try and do it on my own.
To be fair, I tried to guess how many it was in the chapter when the old crone first said it to
him. Oh, yeah, last chapter.
Oh, right.
And then, yeah. Fair enough.
And then I was super concerned as to why Dougal trying to kill him with an axe was not the first death mentioned.
Ah, yeah. Well, because he forgets it and she brings it up. But yeah. So this is what I wrote down, and it doesn't mean I have all the answers, but I wrote down everything except for one because he brought it up, but she was like, no, she brought it up and he was like, but you could count it, I think, this back in time. So potentially seven. So one at the Abbey. He was ill at the Abbey. Two after Culloden. Three, Leary shot him. Four, Snake bit him. Five, when Claire first met him, he'd almost bled to death. And Jamie disagrees. He says it's only a wee scratch, but that is. Oh, sorry. That was when he was shot. Sorry.
No, when she first met him, it was a dislocated shoulder.
Yes, but he gets shot shortly after that. Remember when he falls off the horse?
In the escape, he does get shot. Yeah.
Yes.
And so not when she immediately comes to the stones, but that was in the first, you know, day or of her meeting him. So day or day and a half. So anyway, so that one he disagrees with. So you can leave that one or take that one. I listed that one, but you can take it or leave it. And then six or five, when Dougal hits him over the head with the axe, they agree on this one. But number seven is what I think Casey said this, or maybe not. Number seven is something that he dismisses. And I'm like, no, this may not be one that Diana counts, but I think the number one of all of these should have been his childhood smallpox, because his mom died in childbed, but his brother died of smallpox. Many people died of it. So I don't know how you can't count that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but if he doesn't count it because he didn't have a severe case of it, I mean, the bottom line is he doesn't get to say the parameters of which life counted or didn't.
Absolutely. But that's what I'm saying. We don't know.
And if old crone fortune teller believed that to be one of his nine lives, he has less than he thinks.
If he has seven, he's got two left. If he has five, well, obviously you guys can do the math, but yeah. So I think you can make an argument for between five and seven.
Just to right now, right? We're not talking about future.
No,
okay.
Girl, we don't get ahead talking about books.
I know, but I want to.
Nope. She said they agree on five. So for the purposes of the story, maybe not Diana, or maybe Diana, now that she said they've agreed. For the purposes of Jamie and Claire agreeing, it's five. She says, quote, "You're a very hard person to kill, I think. That's a great comfort to me," end quote. And let's all drink to that, or else we wouldn't be having 10 books. Right? And Amy D. finishes us out with, "At first glance, this chapter seems a bit like a slice of life for Jamie and Claire. Those normal moments that families share. And I love these slices of life. They're what make these stories so rich and engaging. However, there's more to this chapter than perhaps first meets the eye. They talk of Lizzie's illness, Bobby Higgins' hookworm. It's all a kind of dance around the ideas of life and death. In chapter 10, Jamie remembered the fortune teller." Oh, sorry, I was wrong. 10, not... I thought it was 13. 12. Anyway, chapter 10, Jamie remembered the fortune teller in Paris saying you'll die nine times before you rest in your grave. And knowing about the coming revolution, I think maybe Jamie is considering his own mortality. When he asks Claire how many times he's come close to dying, their conversation is a callback to things from previous books. And while it might at first seem a downer of a conversation, Claire's comment about Jamie being a very hard man to kill and that being a great comfort to her brings a bit of levity and reassurance to both her and Jamie and to the readers. So is there anything else left that you would like to get in about chapter 13?
I like the ending. I like the ending. I think, me too. I think it is. I agree with what Amy said, that it was sort of an... You know, they have these warm, quiet moments between them, and it's very, you know, calming, reassuring. It's a nice place to end a chapter.
Well, these are like our Lollipop chapters, right? So in the first few books,
lollipops. No, I'm like, how is it a lollipop?
No, the first few books when they're still in Scotland, those are the moments of rest before the big action happens again. So honestly, I like the slice of life moments, the quiet moments that make it feel real. But at the same time, I know that everything's about to go to hell in a handbasket in a few chapters because you can't be at rest too long in a Gabaldon novel.
Let me see. We're on chapter 13. We're about to go to 14. So it's about 10 chapters from now. Yep.
You have the number and you're ridiculous.
I just know what chapter it's in. Yeah, I'm not going to say what it is, but.
I honestly, Ginger, I can't wait to get ahead of where the series left us, the TV series.
Me too.
Because
me too.
I feel too. Like the TV series spoiled me for my read-along.
That's funny. Even though you've already read, but you don't remember.
I read it, but you know, I try not to hold too much. I only have so much room in my brain for new information. So some stuff has to leave to make room for the new stuff. So I'm rediscovering the joys of A Breath of Snow and Ashes.
It was my second favorite. It is after book two. This is how I explain it. Outlander. It's kind of like, I mean, it's not for me, at least. It's not a Bible. It's not a sacred text. But out of the big books, it's like nothing really compares to it because that's when you first meet these people. And it's, you know, it's all the special juiciness, whatever. But book two is my favorite and then book six. And sometimes book six kind of edges out. And because there's so much that happens in book six, so much, it's kind of ridiculous. All the things and all the people who are in book six that if you haven't read it for a while, it'll surprise you when you re-remember. Or re-meet or reconnect, I guess, with things that you maybe didn't remember. And so it's, oh boy, it's, this book is a lot, and it seems to never, it's also, if I'm not mistaken, it's the longest. So they get progressively longer to book six, but even book eight was not as long as book six.
Well, I mean, we haven't seen book nine yet. So
no, that's true. Well, what was the longest that's published?
All right. And moving right along to chapter 14, entitled People of the Snowbird.
Can I say who my favorite character
Absolutely.
Is?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so my favorite character is Bird's brother. I have to look at his name. I think it's Bear Killer. Is it Bear
Killer? No, Bear Killer. Bear Killer was Jamie.
Oh no, Bear Killer's Jamie. Right. It's Stillwater. It's the brother Stillwater. And the reason I like him is because he's not diplomatic. And so but you get honesty from him, right? Because he blurts out what he's really thinking. So Bird Who Sings in the Morning is, you know, the diplomat. He's the one that's having negotiations with Jamie, the new agent. But Stillwater is the one who sits, like, he smiles when he thinks things are funny, and he just blurts things out when he thinks things are unfair. And so I felt like he was my favorite because he explained things for me.
It's always important to have somebody who doesn't care as a narrator at some point in your book, because you're never going to get the unpolished, unedited truth from somebody who cares.
Yeah.
So I'm
a fan. You might get a comfortable truth, but it's not going to necessarily tell you everything that you probably maybe should know.
Anyway, I liked him. I thought he was, I enjoyed reading about him. So
Jamie and young Ian, as Casey alluded to, have made it to the Cherokee Village. And Bird Who Sings, or I should say A Cherokee Village, because we learn later on that this is not the first one they've been to recently. Bird Who Sings in the Morning says to tell the king that they want guns. So he's there as, you know, we kind of went back and forth on using this term, but in speaking about Native Americans, we do try to use Native Americans if we don't have their name, or if we don't have a name of a tribe, or a name of a people, a nation. But in spots where it's a noun, such as Indian agent, only when it actually comes, like, we don't, you know, go off and have chats about that word. But in the context of the book, or a book, or the chapter where it occurs and where it's used, that is the name that these people, like, that's their title. But it's Summer and I have said this many times. It's not a word I love to use, obviously, but that's what Jamie has taken on for himself, is the role of Indian agent here. And so as we said before, his role as the king's agent, we can say that too, as the king's agent to the Native people, is to speak with them, to not necessarily to promise them things, but basically the king wants to play nice, right? Get in with the Native populations so that if and when things go to hell in a handbasket, there's a chance he might be able to depend on them to fight on the king's side and not pair with the settlers, etc., or the settler, because they're technically, I mean, they're in America, they're in the colonial America, but they're still technically English subjects. So, you know, how it's all kind of a big ball of a lot of stuff.
But I did love the visual of them being like, you go tell the king. And I'm like, he's not going to go anywhere near the king.
Exactly. He can't. And so anyway, so they've been to a number of these villages. And as we find out later on, he hadn't intended to come to this specific one. It was when he was visiting one that was it Bird's brother? Someone said, you need to come visit this tribe. You need to come visit this village. This and speak with Bird. And so that's why he's here. But as far as his mission in general, this is definitely part of his mission. It hasn't changed. And so he's going there to speak with them, to maybe make some promises, but not anything like guns. He can't promise that yet. But he wants to lay the groundwork for building this relationship. And so while he cannot, Bird's like, straight up, tell the king I want guns. That's it. And he's like, I can't promise the guns yet. And then he says, you know, inquiring, why do you want them? Would this be to kill the king's own people? Of course, he just says it in different words. Bird is practical. He's like, we could kill them without guns if we want to. Touche. because he has, but he's, Jamie says, not yet. He basically says, well, you're a wise man that you're not, but I cannot promise guns, not yet. And the Cherokee perceive Ian, and it's more than just one moment. There are a few moments before Diana actually writes this, but the Cherokee definitely perceive Ian to be Mohawk, and he makes them all wary. Like, they're not, I think it's good that he's there because he helps with potential interpretation of languages, and definitely he's an asset, but people do accept him or perceive him as a Mohawk, and so they're wary of him. So that's also important, not just in this context of what they are doing and what Jamie's role is here, but also to remind us that, you know, Ian, because Ian's back with his family, right? But he, since we're not seeing it on TV, we're not seeing it except for in our minds in the book. It's something that Diana, you know, every once in a while, I don't know if she needs to, but she does it, and she does it very well, reminding us Ian is still other. Ian is still other. And he's other to his own people, although his family accepts him, but he's also other, and sometimes dangerously so, to other native peoples.
Right, but he's other in a way that he's still recognized as a specific other. So, I mean, it's like, it's not just that he went and was indoctrinated into this tribe and joined this tribe. It was that he came out being so deeply rooted in that tribe that even other tribes don't see him as white anymore.
Yes. And so Jamie has an entree to asking about them not killing people who cross the treaty line, because they had mentioned that this was a problem. We want guns. There's this treaty line. The settlers are coming and passing, and they're settling our land, and they're growing their crops, and they're saying, like, this is a problem. And so this is actually an entree for Jamie to go further with that, and he asks. While Bird, I believe, says, no, we're, you know, no, we don't do this. And Jamie says, you're wise not to do that, meaning kill them at this moment. And Jamie says, but not everyone is wise, are they? He's using this as an entree to ask about the banditti, those roving hordes that do this damage that we don't know about yet. We know about, but we don't know who they are yet. And Jamie mentions the burnings he's heard of course, the Dutch cabin and others, people being killed, women being taken. Their talk concludes, and then it's time to partay.
Partay.
Yeah, they go how smoke and drink. And
how are you spelling that?
P-A-R-T-E-H.
Because I was hearing T-A-Y, partay.
Oh, no, I said partay. Erica B. writes, a hard conversation with the local native folks about how the white people are breaking past treaty lines and how they need more guns to protect their land. At least Jamie is relatively honest about the likelihood that they'll get them, which is not, at least not anytime soon. Lee M. writes, Jamie and Ian go on embassage to the Cherokee. In his strategic way, Jamie tries to discover if Bird's people have had any involvement in burning out the settlers by suggesting that Bird would be too wise to do such a thing. And when their partaying is done, as Jamie and young Ian walk toward the guest house where they'll be spending the night, Ian tells Jamie, quote, just because Bird says... This made me laugh. It's like out of nowhere you get these lines and it just like guffaw. Diana is so rich. Quote, just because Bird says you're a funny man, Uncle Jamie, I wouldn't go believing it. He's only being polite, Ken. I mean, why you gotta be like that, young Ian? No one's hurting you. No one's stepping on you. What's going on? Let Jamie.
I think Ian is complaining because Jamie's doing dad jokes.
So this is his, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
So that's him. That's what you'd say to your dad, right? When your dad is making a pun that's a dad joke, you roll your eyes and you say, you're not as funny as you think you are. And that's exactly what Ian is saying here. Ian made a derisive noise with his lips, you know, like whatever. You
know? What a buzzkill.
Yeah,
exactly.
He has so little. Let him have this.
Yeah, but you know what? Ian gets the last laugh in this chapter.
Oh, does he?
He gets the last.
Oh, does he? Yeah. A laugh or 28 million? Yes. So as they settle in for sleep, Jamie asks Ian, as he's gossiping about, quote, let it be known, tactfully, that the king would be pleased to know exactly who in hell's been burning cabins, and might be pleased enough to cough up a few guns in reward, unquote. Now, they know that if they did it, meaning if Bird's people did it, they would not fess up to it, but if they know another band who's doing it, they just might, for the possibility of those guns. So, in order to see who would get the best bed, because one of them is, like, beautiful and got blankets and furs, and the other one, I don't know if they really described it, but it's not that, they toss a coin for who would have the best bed, and Jamie won. Apparently, this isn't new on this trip, and Ian's, like, had it. He's like, how do you do that? Every night you say tails, and every night tails it is. It's like, first, young Ian, has Uncle Jamie told you of the fortune teller? He's got crazy luck. Or maybe a cheater coin. And then I realize, no, it's actually Ian's coin. And Ian looks at it. And he sees, Jamie tells him to look at it. And he sees a bit of wax on one side. And that's been what's leading to all the tales. Okay, it's not the luck of the Shaw. But it's still pretty funny that Jamie let this go on that long. I mean, hey, it's not his fault it got there. So he removes it and they go to bed.
I mean, is that the only coin he owns?
That, I mean, I don't know, but he keeps using it. So it makes me think it's one that he likes at least.
Right. Because he remembered the exact moment it happened. Like it wasn't just like, I've noticed that your coin has a little extra stuff on the nose. But he's like, remember that time when somebody blew that candle out and it got all over everything? That exact coin was there. And it's covered in wax. Like, that is like crazy recall.
That's specific.
Right?
Yes. So Jamie thinks about McDonald and how happy he would be with Jamie's work thus far. And the trip to Snowbird's village, as I said, was not in the plans. But at the previous village they visited, some men. Okay, so it wasn't the brother, I don't think. But some men who were there looking for wives had asked Jamie to come back with them to Snowbird's village, and Jamie still had some goodies left for trade, gifts, so he said, sure. It was the first time anyone had ever visited Snowbird as an agent, so it was actually a good idea for Jamie to do so. If he's already out there doing this, and you have stuff that you can give as gifts, why not do it? Because, you know, you're only, especially for the first one there, like making first contact in that manner for that purpose is what he needs to do. Like the whole reason he did it, besides the fact that he, you know, could do it, or not that he wanted to, but was to make sure it would be better him than the Browns. And so he's looking at this is one more opportunity to get in there before the Browns have done that or who have gotten to anyone else.
I think we need a new shirt designed that just says, I hate the Browns, because I literally almost said it again.
So he has a thought or two of Roger and his collection of the Protestants. And then he thinks about the white sow and how dang fertile she is. And what the size of the balls of the boar must be who mates with her.
But did he eat her? That was my favorite line. I'm like, did she eat him afterwards? She's like, we know she's cantankerous, but I mean, the fact, like, imagining her to be like a praying mantis of the pig world.
Or a, the spider, the
Black Widow.
Oy vey.
She's the White Widow sow.
The White Widow sow. So just as they go to sleep, Jamie feels a hand. I heard a giggle. Jamie feels a hand on his privates. And I wrote, okay, so this took a left turn.
Well, there was a moment where I was like, wait, is he having a dream? Like, is that a, like a weird
it's Claire.
Dream? And then it was so like the
thing
multiple.
The thing that struck me was, where were they when all the, you know, flipping the coin for the
yes!
bed was going on? like were they like silently in the bed there, or did they creep in afterward? Like, I feel like they had to have been there, because Jamie's so good at creeping up. Like he's Mr. Good at stalking. So he would have known if somebody had just crept in the door. So I feel like they were hiding under the covers myself.
But how did he not notice? I mean, it must have been a really bumpy bed for him to not notice two like full grown ladies underneath the covers.
Can I just say, speaking of beds, I don't think it was this chapter, or it definitely wasn't this chapter, but it was earlier, and it was where Claire is with Jamie and she tightens the key on the bed.
Yeah.
And That was such an interesting, that's so, like, that's one of the details that I just love, you know, because that's just pure, perfect research, where in contemporary world, we have our mattresses and you've got a bed frame or whatever. You don't have to worry about these things. But in those days, if you didn't want your mattress to sag in the middle, you had to tie those ropes tight and you had to crank the thing to tighten them. And so anyway, this bed obviously didn't have one of those. It was lumpy, and they couldn't tell that there were two cute little cuties hiding under the covers.
But they waited until he was just falling asleep, which
they did. They were so clever.
Which made me think that they had snuck in, like, that, because I can't imagine laying in a bed with two other people in it and not noticing until I was almost asleep.
Now I'm imagining a pallet. Like a big, comfy pallet. So,
but they said that it was a pallet for Ian, that Ian was on the pallet floor,
Oh,
and that,
so
and that Jamie had the nice bed. That's why they flipped for it, right? So that's where I think there is a possibility. Like, maybe they were hiding under the bed.
Oh, there you go. That makes sense.
If it was a nice bed, right, it could have had an underneath that they could.
That's
I don't
just
know.
Creepy. That's
anyway,
just a they, creepy thought.
The whole thing was quite implausible for me. Like, by the end, like, I just felt like this was Jamie torture again. Well, anyway,
Jamie torture. You
go ahead, and then I'll give my summation.
Sure.
At the end.
Okay. So, quote: feminine fingers wiggled gently in his grasp, and the hand's fellow promptly took up operations in its stead. Unquote. So basically, Jamie would make a good, so this is like what they talk about or say, a little bit of a wrap up here, not a wrap up, but a summary of that scene. Basically, Jamie would make a good stud for some Cherokee babies.
No, they would not make good stud because they didn't want red haired babies.
Well, that's what
they were offended by, the red hair. Yeah.
Yes. But okay. But let's send some of our, yes, okay, yes. So the women were sent there to honor the king, because this man, although he's not the king, he's the king's representative. So it's an honor to send them to him. And he hisses at Ian in desperation. He hears Rollo sneeze. And Ian's, they were like, you know, falling asleep as they were walking back to the, or getting ready to go to bed. And now Ian's fully awake and he asks, "What is it, Uncle?" Mm-mm. And he sounds extremely calm, not like he'd just woken up. And Jamie says, "Ian, there's a woman in my bed." And Ian corrects him, "There are two of them. The other will be down at your feet waiting her turn."
Good Lord.
Okay, so I just realized this. Was Ian in on it then? Was he in on
he
it?
He definitely knew that it was a possibility. Like, he did not seem surprised at all, which makes me think that he saw them come in and get in the bed.
That's
and
maybe,
not
yeah.
freaked right. out. Yeah, but yeah, he did not.
Right.
He was not
because
surprised.
He did. You're right. He did not at all sound surprised. Not at all.
And he seemed more surprised
like he was
that Jamie hadn't figured out it was going to happen. Like, he's like, "Oh well, I mean, this is guess, what happens when you're the Indian. What is it called? Indian agent."
Agent
of the king. Yeah. Yep. And now they're biting him. And Ian tells him, Jamie, that they think he's the king as his agent. So they honor his majesty by sending me, the Cherokee honor his majesty, the king, by sending you his women. Now Jamie's foot's being tickled by the second woman. Meanwhile, he's still playing, this is Diana's words, hide the sausage with the first woman. And he tells Ian, talk to them. And Ian's like, "What do you want me to say?"
I think he needs...
Like, Ian, you're such a meanie right now.
He's so mean. I think he needs to rename his junk his royal majesty, or the majesty, his majesty the king. Because if they're honoring, if they're going to be honoring his majesty the king, we should have the proper renaming.
Hold on. Maybe not. Because speaking of junk, who's still alive in this book is Stephen Bonnet, and his junk is called Le Roi, which is the king. So maybe not.
Right.
Well, it's
Diana's
not.
Diana's
but he's not. But he's not His Majesty the King. I mean, come on. There's some pomp and circumstance that goes with
yeah,
having
but it's,
more
that,
titles.
That's a synonym for someone who's royal, and that's a little bit close to Stephen Bonnet junk. So, come on, Ian. Jamie says to tell them that he's aware of the honor meant, but By now, Ian is lying on the floor, absolutely laughing. And that's what I'm saying. This is like, this is so well described. Yeah, implausible, right? Very difficult to like it would happen. Maybe, who knows? But it's fiction. But as far as TV goes, especially like, as Summer said, a pay channel, this is right up Star's alley. Who knows if they'll do it? But this is like a give. This is like a gimme, right? It's so.
It is. I agree. It's a very funny, very sweet scene, though. It's, you know, it's the like my favorite line in all of it is where Jamie shouts out, "Madam." It's just a minute. I'm trying to find it
because he's so proper.
It says, in the midst of his subsequent struggles, he was dimly aware that Ian had lost any sense of self-control and was lying on the floor, giggling helplessly. It was filicide if you kill the son, he thought grimly. What's the word for assassinating a nephew? Madam, he says, disengaging his mouth with difficulty. I just loved it. I thought that was very funny. It was. This was definitely a laugh out loud chapter. And that's so nice to have because there's so much terrible things that happen in this book. So many horrifying things. So it's nice that there's to have, a break like that.
Well, to be fair, I mean, I felt like Game of Thrones, which, you know, we sometimes they're not the same, but they are kind of in the same kind of world where they're books that turned into series that were popular. You kind of feel like when you watched the Game of Thrones show, they had to obligatory have a scene in a brothel. So there were boobies every week. Like it felt like a forced thing. Whereas this is in the book. It's a gimme. It's absolutely a gimme. They don't even have to work for it or make it seem weird. It's just right there.
There's not even much adaptation. It's kind of there.
Also, a big, big difference, can I just say, from the point of view of the writer, a huge difference is that George R. R. Martin's books are written from the male gaze and Outlander books are not. They are written from the female gaze. And even when the stories are told I don't know if you've guys have talked about this at all, but you know, the difference in the voice between when Claire is speaking and any of the other characters, Claire speaks in her own voice and it becomes a first person character. And then when you step into the heads of any of the other characters, it goes into third person limited. And this is, I mean, these are technicalities, but what that does is it takes the principal storytelling, the weight of the story comes through Claire, and that therefore informs the story so that it's got definitely a female gaze. And that's why that is the fundamental difference between those two stories is they're both huge majestic tapestries of stories with many, many characters, but his stories are so boy focused and they're way less respectful to women than Diana's stories.
Absolutely.
This is not to say that she doesn't treat all her characters with like she beats them all up. Like this is a classic example. This very chapter is a classic example of how badly she tortures Jamie. Because what a way to end a chapter. You're not there yet, so I'll just wait. But I mean, he is brutally like that. Who would ask that of any man? He has to just lie still and, you know, and be a good boy. And like, it's poor Jamie. That's all I could think was poor Jamie. You know, you feel for him.
She gave up kind of physically torturing him after the first couple books. And since then she's just been mentally torturing him, but her physical torture has been given to Roger at this point, but
it moves around.
Yeah. But she does have definite focal points for her, whoever she wants to get her physical torture out on.
Yeah.
Lee M. writes, the snowboard people have decided to honor Jamie by providing him with a couple of very handsy and enthusiastic bed warmers. This is one of the funniest scenes ever. I agree. Out of all 8 books, I agree.
They were handsy and mouthy.
Both of the women were naked. He pushes them off, covers himself up with the furs and blankets and says, this is on the lines of Madam, right? Covers himself with the furs and blankets and says, cease, the two of you. You are beautiful, but I cannot lie with you. It's so formal. And Jamie's like so proper that it's so incongruous with him. And it's so funny. And then he knows he has to save myself. he starts by saying, he's like, I can't. And they're like, huh? And he says, because there's an oath upon me, I have sworn. And he's like, I can't, I don't know. He can't finish. He doesn't know what to say. So Ian speaks to them. And basically what he translates to Jamie was, the Great Spirit came down to you in a dream and told you you mustn't go with a woman until you'd brought guns to all that Salagi. And Jamie's like, excuse me, what? But he's like, it's all I can think of under pressure, Uncle. But it worked.
And I mean, it's never going to happen. So he has a perfect out.
I thought it was a perfect out. Yeah. It was so perfect. It almost could have been prepared.
Exactly.
If he was in
exactly. And Jamie kind of reflects for a moment and he's like, well, there were a lot of Salagi. So he's definitely saving his willy for a while. So if they were all going to get guns, it would be a long time coming. So it's very safe.
This is a minor point, but I believe it's Salagi.
Salagi?
Yeah.
Oh, are you listening to Davina?
No, I'm listening to you and my time that I spent on the Cherokee reservation for 2 summers and they never pronounced it the way you are. Yeah.
So the women consider this. Okay. One is disappointed because she says he's very nicely equipped. And the other is thinking maybe it's for the best because, you know, redheaded children. Since it was raining and they didn't feel like they could send them out, but he asks, Ian asks the women if they wanted to lie with Bear Killer as long as they could avoid his privates, apparently. So because that's what they ended up doing. So this is what we believe Ian has told them. Ian is loving this. And Jamie, or Diana says about Jamie, quote, he thought it was maybe the first time he heard Ian truly laugh since his return, unquote. And I thought, you know what? For all the stuff that Jamie goes through and that Ian allows him to be put through here, it is worth it. This whole thing is worth it for Ian's continued recovery and continued healing. So we've already kind of talked about it. I think I know your opinions, but since the show made a big deal about Ian, thankfully so, and his return and his gruffness and his character and how he never smiled and all of that, do we think they'll keep this scene? I mean, as we already said, it's made for the screen, especially for Stars.
At this point, it would be a backwards motion because they've already passed this part in the book with how they've adapted the season for season 5.
Oh, are they not having him be an agent then?
I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see. I don't know that we're there. They didn't have him having a whiskey still that exploded either. I mean,
true. You know, when you think about it, the vastness of these books, I think it's probably they end up taking like about 10% of the story. There's so much detail that's lost. And so it would be sad if this was lost, though, because it's such a funny scene. And it's just, it's enjoyable. It made me laugh out loud to read it. And so I it would be a shame, but there's so much that's gone in the series. They have to be judicious in their choices, I guess. I mean, that's why the books are better.
Books are always
better.
That's
why the books are, books are always better. Yeah.
She says to the author.
Yeah. Yeah. I know nobody's made a movie out of any of my books
yet.
Not yet.
No, but your last one. I mean, either of the last two, but especially your last one. Oh my gosh.
I reserve judgment to be able to say whether the book is better once somebody makes a movie.
Fair enough. So Erica B writes, I can't imagine how unsettling it would be to wake being fondled and essentially on the verge of being raped. This is not okay for anyone to do. And at the end of this passage, it made me laugh. I'm glad it lifted Ian's spirits away. And then Erica finishes with, being a quote Indian agent is going to be very interesting, it seems. If this was happening on the trip out. Yeah, that's true. And Lee M closes us out with, this is getting to be a very convenient excuse for getting out of stuff. Ian tells them that Jamie cannot sleep with them until King George gives all Snowbird's people guns. The women bed down for the night. They stop being so grabby, but Jamie is not getting much sleep anyway.
And that was chapter 14. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapter 15. Only one next week, you guys.
Oh my.
It is entitled Stake It to Drune. which makes me think of, you know, Bonnet. But then I flipped through it and I couldn't find any references to Bonnet. So it's got to be just a reference to being staked into the water to drown. We'll see.
Ominous title. Right?
I was like, ominous for several reasons. One, because you first have to translate it. Because those are not,
oh yeah,
those are
true.
Not words that we generally see in the English language. One, and then you're like, is it just accented English, or are those actual words, or is it another language? So, I have a lot of hard times with some of her titles. Like the entire time she was in France, I was like, I'm not reading these titles. Book two, I don't think I read many of the chapter titles.
Welcome. You're always welcome.
Thank you.
Of course, of course.
And if you'd like to continue the conversation, please join us at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And in there, it's not quite a free-for-all because we do have some rules about what we are and aren't allowed to talk about, which books are free, which ones aren't. But there's rules everywhere, and we're happy to have you join us and learn them. And if you've ever had a burning need to wear my art on your face, or maybe on your chest, or you just want to walk around and be like, look, it's the Stones, y'all, please go to www.outlanderpod.com/shop and find out more about how you can share your love of Outlander and Outlander Pod with the world.
And again, a very special thanks to this episode's co-producer and our friend, Carlene Z. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit patreon.com/outlanderpod. Thank you guys, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.